When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And that's why it's so hard for us in the SEAL teams when one of us dies. And since we've had so many die, we close ranks, I guess, the best way to say it. So, I mean, and we deal with it together. You got to understand, I'm not alone.
Welcome to The Art of Charm. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Today, we're talking with former Navy SEALs Marcus Luttrell and David Rutt Rutherford. We're going to talk about how civilians can develop mental toughness and how someone without military training can cultivate and maintain self-discipline to do the difficult things necessary to reach their goals, and what mental practices Navy SEALs use to block out distraction and physical pain to stay focused on the goals at hand. And of course, I had to ask, do SEALs suffer as well from imposter syndrome? We're so glad to have you with us today here at AOC. So enjoy this episode with Marcus Luttrell and David Rutherford. Oh, and by the way, if you're new to the show, we'd love to send you some top episodes and the AOC toolbox where we discuss things like body language and nonverbal communication, persuasion, networking, negotiation, mentorship, and everything else we teach here at The Art of Charm. In the U.S., you can text CHARMED to 33444. That's CHARMED to 33444. Everywhere else, and the USA, what am I talking about here? Everywhere, you can go to theartofcharm.com, and also at theartofcharm.com/podcast. You can find the full show notes for this and all previous episodes. All right, here are Marcus Luttrell and Rutt. So it's funny, we prepped for this so long ago. I mean, a really, really long time ago, probably a year ago. We watched a lot of the interviews that you did, Marcus, with a lot of journalists. And I thought these were interesting because it seemed like none of them really even tried to put themselves in your shoes at all. I wrote down in my notes, let's be the guys that don't screw up an interview with Marcus Luttrell, right? Because I watched probably 20 interviews with you. The one where you're on stage with the dog, your dog's there. And this, that was like the best one. And I feel like you still secretly just wanted to get up and leave in the middle. because they're either unprepared or they're political or they put their foot in their mouth in the most awkward way possible. So I really wanted to do this right.
No. Hey, guys, throughout the transitions in our lives, I mean, I'm a husband and a father. And
once I turn, podcaster.
Yeah, podcaster is what I do for a living. So now once I turn 40, I mean, I don't have any problem with anything I ever did in my life. Like, I don't have PTSD. I can talk about anything. I'm real open about my life's been public for a long time now. So I can talk about anything you guys want to talk about. And like I said, Rutt and I have been together through most of it. So,
well, good.
Feel free
good.
To fire whatever you want. I mean, if there's, don't be afraid to ask any questions. Don't think you're going to insult me. I mean, if you do, you know, I'll let you know.
Yeah, let me know. Find you guys. He will come yeah, find right. you guys and kill you.
You know what? If that's what happens, at least it'll make the news.
No, it won't.
Anything for the story.
Hey, Rutt, no, it won't.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. No, it'll just look like it. Natural causes. Right. Right. He was so young. What happened? Yeah. Must have been the stress of the job. He fell off his own roof twice.
How do you wreck your car twice?
Yeah, it was really, it's so mysterious. Anyway, we're going to drop this investigation. We have better things to attend to. Yeah, so Marcus and Dave, should I call you Rutt? I feel like, do I not get to call you Rutt, or is that what everyone calls you?
You know what? You can call me Rutt. So Rutt is totally cool.
Looking back at the lone survivor phenomenon, just to give people context of your background, tell us briefly what happened. Again, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, Marcus, but if you can give us a brief rundown of the story just so people recognize kind of the extreme experience, and then we can deconstruct what happened thereafter and what's happening now.
Sure, absolutely. 2005, I was in SEAL teams, deployed to Afghanistan on a reconnaissance platoon. We infilled to capture, kill a high-value target, and then we got overrun by a small militia. Then a gunfight ensued. About 3 hours went by, and then my reconnaissance team consisted of about 4 men. After about 3 hours, they were all dead. And then after that, crawled for another day, right? Yeah, crawled through the night.
Well, you had to crawl pretty far.
Yeah, pretty far. And then 7 miles.
Yeah, with a few broken bones. Yeah, and shattered.
I was pretty busted up.
No tongue.
Yeah. And I got rescued by a Pashtun village. And then for the next 4.5 days, I was with the Taliban and with the village. And then U.S. military came in and rescued me. And then after that, let's see, in the hospital for a while. Then
3 months?
Went back, yeah.
Then, surgeries?
Yeah, had some surgeries, got back together, went back into Iraq in 06 and 07. And then
for the Battle of Ramadi, he likes Jordan. One of the things he does because of his, you know, being so humble is he glosses over these incredible accomplishments.
We're going to get into that. Let me sort of back up here. Your team went out. You had a decision where you had to essentially decide whether or not to execute some goat herders that happened upon your reconnaissance patrol, correct?
Correct.
And you did not do that because they were just civilians. However, those people alerted the Taliban, which then quickly overran the position that you guys were in, and you were, as the movie title implies, the lone survivor of this. And you said you crawled 7 miles through the night. Can you tell us, it's exactly what it sounds like from my research, but tell us exactly what's going on there. Because yes, you're glossing over, as Rutt says, some of the details because of humility, but we want to get the high performance version of this and figure out how the hell you were even able to do that.
Sure. So at the end of the gunfight, my Matt Axelson and myself were separated by an RPG blast and knocked us out again. That's kind of one of the difficult parts about the mission was how many times we kept getting knocked out. And when I came to at the end of that, Axe and I had been separated and everybody was dead. And I was paralyzed from the waist down. I'd been shot at frag from head to toe kind of deal, broken back. I mean, I was pretty busted up, man. My face was smashed in. But anyways, I was almost naked. I mean, all my uniform, my kit, my med gear, GPS, compass. I mean, I had my rifle left, had one mag left. And what I did was I just started crawling. I crawled into this crevice, and I buried myself. And I lay there for a while, well, until the sun went down. And then I uncovered myself, and I started crawling through the night. And I knocked myself out a couple more times. And the sun came up, and I was trying to work my way down this hill. And I guess they found me that morning, or if they'd been following me, I don't know. I got walked on by HKT, Hunter Killer Team, and I got shot in the back. Anyways, I rolled down this hill. I came to. There was two guys shooting at me, and one guy was chasing me hilltop for hilltop. So I just rolled over and started crawling, and I would throw myself and roll down the backside of these hills kind of deal, and I turned around on one of them, and then that one guy walked right into me, and I shot him in the face. Then the other two guys, their high ground turned into my level ground. It's kind of hard to explain. We were on the side of a mountain, but I had a frag left, and I dumped it on them. And then this is when I was busted up real bad. I couldn't really feel anything from my chest down. So I grabbed a rock and I drew a line in front of me. So I would crawl to this line and I'd fall down a hill and I'd crawl up another hill. I just kept crawling. I did for 7 miles, and I found a waterfall, believe it or not. Check this out. And I don't know how I managed to do this, but I got to the top of the waterfall and I tried to slide down into the river and I took off, man. I flipped into the river, knocked myself out again. My knees hit me in the face this time. It's pretty gnarly, but most humans don't bend like that.
Yeah.
And I came to. I got 2 sips out of that waterfall. I remember how cold it was because it was coming off the mountain, and I remember it was being a good place to die. And I was sitting down. I got one more sip out of the waterfall, and that's when the village found me.
When you're hiding in the crevice, are you thinking, I shouldn't move until nightfall? I know this because of my training. Or are you just like, I'm so tired, I need to rest here no matter what?
No, nightfall. I mean, we'd been overrun and everyone was dead. It's a tactic.
Right. And then you drew a line in the sand with the rock just to give you a goal that you could accomplish. Crawl over the line, draw another line in the sand ad nauseum for 7 miles until you find this waterfall. And just think about how far that is. When you're listening right now, if you're driving your morning commute, think about how many miles that is in your car and think about crawling that, right?
Just to put it in perspective, I mean, I would fall down the other side. I mean, 7 miles on your feet's a lot longer than when you can roll down. I mean, so don't see, I'm not a badass, you know, I mean, I use gravity to my advantage.
I think it's interesting that you're trying to cut your credit a little short by saying, no, I fell onto rocks a lot of the ways instead of crawling. It's not as cool as it sounds. I mean, that sounds worse.
I didn't do anything that any other frogman would have done in my place. That's the thing. I did exactly what I was supposed to do. That's why I don't like taking a lot of credit for that, because any guy could have done that in any point in time. And we all came from the same mold, and the young guys, I can't, you know, you can't have guys coming in thinking that I could do something another team guy couldn't, because I can't really. And everybody who went through SEAL training with me and was in the teams with me, man, knew I was good. I wasn't the greatest. I wasn't the worst, man. I just good enough to be there.
I understand.
Well, what's interesting to me is because, I was with Marcus. He came through training when I was an instructor.
Right. So,
to a certain extent, he's absolutely 100% accurate, right? We don't distinguish from one guy to the next. But one thing that Marcus will never say is that he did stand out. And I can tell you, as being one of his instructors, and the fact that he was a medic, I did push him harder than the other guys because he was a medic and he did live up to it all the time. So, it's very difficult perspective.
That's all I did. I just met the standards that were put up.
You met the standards. And then, unfortunately, when the standard came to call on Marcus that fateful day in June of, he performed at the highest level and he didn't die. He didn't quit.
Okay, I used every skill I'd ever been taught. And this is the reason, look, you got to understand, because I'm not in that special class where you can just learn anything and do anything. Like, I actually have to train. So I'm trained in everything that, so is every other SEAL, but I got to train myself to learn it, to get good at it. So when it did come time when all of it fell apart, I know it. I knew everything I needed to know.
You felt like you had to outwork or work hard to get it. It wasn't like, I'm naturally good at all this stuff, right?
Everybody has to work hard to get it. That's the problem with being a Navy SEAL. My hardest I gave was good enough to be there. It wasn't any better, any worse. Am I saying that? I don't even know how to, I never had to talk about this.
No, you're spot on. You're crushing it. I mean, one of the things, Jordan, about, the standards is that our standards are so high throughout the entirety of the training. And that's how we, that's how we become what we become. That's how we're able to do the things we're able to do. The challenges is the operational environments, sometimes go south, and in particular individuals in those situations, they do remarkable, extraordinary things. So,
We got tons of guys. Y'all just don't ever hear about them because there's no fallen angels. We don't have any of the helicopters getting shot down. So that's another thing that I keep in my head. You got to understand, Red Wing, we got beat. That's a loss. Like I'm known in our community because I survived our greatest casualty, our loss. And it's, I don't want to say embarrassing. It wasn't embarrassing in the teams. It's just like, all right, I got to work extra hard because I got beat to get back into the club. And that's the drive. And that's how we work. Every one of them guys who has any of those situations, when they get into it, man, they get right back in the line and go, anonymous. And that's what I had to do till, well, the book.
When you guys get in these types of situations, what are you guys thinking? Like, what is going through your head? Are you on autopilot because of training? Are you thinking about your friends and family? I assume there's not a lot of time feeling sorry for yourself because that's not very helpful. But there's got to be a little bit of that, right? There has to be some massive mix of very powerful emotions happening whenever you get into situations like this.
I don't think so. I think it's more about the first of what you talked about. It's, the training becomes rote, right?
The training is so we do the evolution to fail and then get beat and want to stay there
for the next beat,
for the next beating
and the next
to fail again. And that's how they condition us. So when we go out on real targets, man, we go out expecting to take pain, expecting to get everything we got in the aspect of there's a possibility we might fail.
Yeah. And when a lot of people watch this, like when I watched the movie and read the book, I felt really helpless. But I assume that while you're out there, you don't feel the same way because you summoned a lot of strength to survive this.
And I think that's one of the reasons why we're doing what we're doing together now is because we believe that every individual ultimately has a component of pushing themselves beyond their limits. Look at the fact that you were kidnapped twice, which is a story, by the way, we want to hear on our,
come on.
We want to hear that and how you got out of that and what kept you going.
Yeah, I will do that on your show. We can definitely discuss the kidnapping stuff on your program if you want, because there's probably some similarities. I just don't think about it as like, I'm this badass guy, because I think about it like you guys do, which is, wow, this did not go my way. I'm just lucky to be here.
All right. Now here's the way I look at it. That's just because you didn't go to the same school we did.
Yep.
And it's a training thing. You got to understand, you are very much capable. When I got snatched up, I had been trained to handle everything. That's why, even on the outside, we're trained to do this and we just practice until we get good at it. And bro, from what I've heard about you, man,
He's got one of the biggest podcasts in the country.
I mean,
when you first started, did you ever imagine that you would have, you know, 550 plus shows and 2 million listeners a month? No, you just don't imagine that. You hope for it, but because of the commitment and your willingness to sacrifice and other components and accept the pain of building something, you got to become the best at what you're doing right now, Jordan. That's the same mindset we do. We just apply different components of pain.
Yeah, and that's it. The levels of pain, because look, when it goes off, man, all the training, everything comes into me, man. I don't care. I don't even think about myself. I'm thinking about my boys and what they're doing, and it's vice versa, because if I die, they're alive. I'm still alive. That's the kind of the mentality. And the reason you can't break us mentally is because you had to break every single one of us. And I think, man, the only way you're going to beat me mentally is if you got to break every single one who wears a Trident on their chest, and you ain't getting that done.
Right. Yeah. This makes sense. And looking back at the team mindset, I mean, even producer Jason here says, you know, part of the reason that we're successful, which is very, very true, is that there's always people behind you holding it up. And so you hold each other accountable and you make it happen. When you were out there, did you realize that people were looking for you, or were you just like, man, I freaking hope that somebody knows I'm still out here? Are you just, you know, what's going through your head when you're in the Potsdam Village? Are you thinking it's just any day now, or are you thinking, crap, I wonder if they think I'm gone and they're not going to come?
No, I mean, I was using my radio beacon. I was doing all my signaling. I was writing and gaining intel from the villagers, and then writing, you know, drawing maps out on my, well, we won't go there, but
yeah,
in the preparation, I knew they were coming to get me. Oh, no, you don't. That's not even an option. I mean, there's dudes back home coming to get me kind of deal.
Right.
I didn't know about the helicopter getting shot down and all the guys dying. I mean, the Taliban had me. They told me that, but I don't, you got to understand the mindset. Don't go in to lose. You can't tell me something negative that's going to sway my attitude when we're going in. So this is the first time we had been whipped. I mean, I was just going off of my mindset was the never been whipped mindset. So, I mean, and I've been through Hell Week. Hell Week's 5 days. So I knew I was good till then. I mean, I was busted. I was getting real sick. But the only problem I didn't think about my teammates being dead. I just thought about the rest of my team coming to get me. Because if you know anything about my career, I can get myself into some pretty unique situations. And I'm not just, I mean, most SEALs can say that, but I mean, ask anybody. Some unique ones, right?
Absolutely.
I don't know what it was, man. We just
one of the interesting, Jordan, is and this is goes back to why I always throw in the humble statement with Marcus, and where I believe is the what does separate him from a lot of other guys in our community. And he doesn't ever want to admit it, but I'm going to say it here because that's what I believe, and that's why I love the guys as much as I do. Is after this incident, after he comes back and he understands it's the single greatest loss that we've had at the time since World War II in our unit. But he has this desire, this need to get healed, Roger up, and go back in a platoon to go to the most dangerous place on earth, which was Ramadi, Iraq, in the battle for Ramadi in 06. That, in my mind, is the exceptional what separates Marcus from so others.
So the SEAL code, or this ethos, is that from the first day of BUDS, and again, this is from my research, I have no military experience, but it says something like, my loyalty to country and team is beyond reproach. I humbly serve as a guardian to my fellow Americans. I do not advertise the nature of my work nor seek recognition for my actions. It seems like you didn't have much of a choice, but you got thrust into the limelight, which is a little bit, I don't know, contra to this. How do you feel about that? Because it seems like it would be a little uncomfortable at first, knowing like, look, I assume you didn't think, hey, this is going to make a great story. Can't wait to tell everybody. That's probably the furthest thing from your mind when all this is happening.
Oh, no. I was in Ramadi when it came out. You understand, this wasn't my idea. I mean, this is my new mission. That kind of deal. I asked the same question you said, like, to the bosses above, and I was like, what do you want me to do? And they were like, you're a Navy SEAL, we expect you to perform. That kind of deal. So I mean, I was trained to go on television and survive in the civilian world, and I got read up on what it meant to be a writer. And hell, all the book is a debrief. So I mean, that's just me telling a debrief. I talk like that.
yeah.
So I didn't really look at it as anything other than doing, you know, I was doing what I was told.
Why did you take it upon yourself to personally travel across the U.S. and tell the families of your fallen brothers exactly how their sons died? I mean, why was that important to you initially?
I'll ask you this question. Who'd you want to hear that from? They need to hear that from me. So anything they heard from anybody else?
It's a really old tradition in our unit as well.
How did you manage that emotionally? Because that must have that's a hurtful thing, I would imagine, for you every time that you do it.
I had my teammates with me.
On the travel?
Yeah.
Because it seems like it would just be really hard, because these people are grieving for almost like the first time for real when they hear it from you, right? Before that, it's just like a letter that they get or something, I assume, or a bad phone call.
So I was with the rest of my team, and you got to understand how we are around each other. It's kind of hard to explain, but I don't feel like that. So that, and we had already buried, not buried them, but we say our goodbyes differently. So once we go through our ritual and it's a kind of a warrior thing, then they're in the ground and our job is to push forward. So we think of them in their spirit, in the best light, where they're fighting with us and stuff like that. And that's it. Our community is real tight knit. So instead of our admiral writing a letter, he sent me, and it doesn't get any more straight up than that. I mean, that's an honor.
Well, I mean, you think about Marcus's ability to translate the pride that those men all fought with on that day. I mean, they fought like true warrior poets. And he was able to disseminate for that to the grieving families who are filled with doubt and wonderment and why and anxiety and anguish and grief and all these things. Marcus was able to instill that sense of pride that their sons died like the heroes are.
Our entire community surrounded all those families, and basically what it was, I was picked to tell them what happened. I mean, even with the admirals and everybody standing there, just because I was there, and that's kind of how it works.
So how do you not let traumatic events like that completely define you, right? Because a lot of times they're probably taking over your thoughts, but what would you say to the father or mother listening to this who somehow blames themselves for the death of a family member or something like that, which would seem to be a similar situation where a family member dies, while you're there? How do you not let that define your life and move forward?
Well, we had a saying in my family, you never let anything define you as a man. I mean, we were Navy SEALs. We're not anymore. That kind of deal was a time in our life. And then you have to understand everybody's realities. I'm about to take you down a rabbit's hole. Russ going to have to step in on this one.
I got you.
Should we go?
Yeah, go.
You ready?
Go.
All right. So everybody's reality is unique to them. They build it themselves to make it perfect. The people who can exist in other people's realities are the ones that succeed, correct? They can either exist or they can dominate in other realities. What we're trained from the very beginning, I mean, they rip everything we were away from us, go in the training. If you had those surrounded by men who think exactly like that, it's the only thought process.
It creates the reality.
Right. And people get on to us about watching a lot of movies. Well, we actually watch the same movies over and over again, and it programs in our mind how to react in certain situations, because I'm seeing that situation unfold in front of me in my eyes. It can unfold exactly like that in real life or similar to that. And I'm already prepared for that kind of reaction and our ability to take pain.
What kind of movies are you talking about? Like, you have kind of almost like SEAL game film that you constantly go over to train? Or is this, what are these movies you're talking about?
It's bigger than that. So like, we will have a core of watching 300, right? About the Spartans. Yeah,
Band of Brothers.
Yeah, Band of Brothers.
Movies. Okay. Hollywood movies.
Hollywood movies that conjure up the culture that we live in reality. And so what we do is we create a higher level camaraderie through those movies. Cause when you're not, like, everybody seems to think that when you go down range, you're going out every single night, it's op. Well, I guess in certain circumstances, in certain times, certain deployments, they did it, but at the
same, just like every other war, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And in downtime, you're spending that time together bonding. And one of the ways we bond significantly is through the manifestation of our glory in those movies. Cause we're living it. I mean, we're watching these things that
in history.
Yeah. We're watching
in Babylon and Afghanistan, where Alexander got, I got whipped where Alexander did. I mean, that's kind of a source of pride for me. You know what I mean? Me and my boys went in all those places and fought. It's that warrior mentality kind of deal. I mean, we were talking about this. We get back from deployment. You get a month break. Dave Grossman gets in our head and sends us back over. Good to go.
Totally.
Wow.
Johnny, we know if you listen to the show, you are driven. In fact, we're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast.
Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey.
We have hired a lot of team members over the last 17 years. Going through endless resumes, well, that's a time sink. But you know what else is a time sink? Interviewing endless people, because they're all going to give you the best face forward.
That's why we love Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every single day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets.
Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast.
And listeners of this show get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/charm. Just go to Indeed.com/charm right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/charm. Terms and conditions apply.
Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Now, back to the show.
When the movies came out about you, the books and the movies came out about you, did you feel a pressure to act a certain way? Like, oh, I've got to be a little bit more heroic and friendly and smiley, or I better stay in good shape because people are looking at me. I mean, did you feel that external pressure to be someone else?
I've been asked that question before. And the way that the public knows me, it's not because I'm an actor and then I had my last movie or something like that. It's my
right
deeds in battle for everybody that just got, everyone knows about it. There's every guy in the military gets in combat, man, they got a story like that. And it just so happens so many people died and mine got told due to the nature of it. And I act like military bearing, and I just like I normally do. I mean, I screw up, you know, I fail in the open quite regularly because, and it's not that big of a deal to me. There's nothing I can do. And we were talking about this earlier, but like, because I got put into the public later in life, you're not seeing me at a young age trying to build my reputation off of something that happened to me. You witnessed something that happened to me off of reputation I already had. And mm-hmm. and that, did I say that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, I'm a husband and a father. I mean, I'm an indoor cat, bro. I work outside and all stuff like that. So it's transitions in life. You push past that, and every little bad moment in my life, I've had a good one. And I've had more good ones than bad, and especially after you get out of combat and you come back home, and I can't let something like a 2 minute or a 5 minute or a 2 year, how long we were over there, snapshot in my life, especially if I'm back with my family, control the good times. So I mean, that's that positive attitude and how I act and react is completely already been taught to me.
That's good, because it sounds like what you're saying, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, so correct me if I'm wrong, the thing that keeps you moving past traumatic experiences like this is realizing that you're not to be defined by the events themselves. You're at home now. You have a different life now. You don't have to constantly relive that. Did friends and people around you start treating you differently after the movie came out? I would imagine there'd be some sort of natural consequence to that type of fame.
I have the same friends I've had since I was a boy, I meet millions of people and they're all great, but are you talking about like who I hang out with? It's my teammates and my core group of friends since I was a boy. Yeah. That's another thing about being where I'm at in my life. The going out and being in the public eye and the tabloids and all that stuff like that. You know, I'm married.
He's a dad.
I'm a dad.
He's a podcaster. I got respect.
You know what? If you really, now that I thought about it, yeah, now that I have kids, I mean, I can't act like a fool sometimes when we do team guy stuff and in the political spotlight now on both. So,
well, one of the interesting things that I thought, yeah, you know,
I don't even know how to explain it, man.
No, and let me help you out, is one of the things, Jordan, that, you know, I witnessed, and you can imagine all of us being his brothers and his teammates going, man, how's he going to manage all this as it blows completely, you know, sideways, you know, when a movie gets in, is that successful, or the phenomenon of his book and the story and why so many people love it, you know, and the pressure on him to get near, you know, whatever that heroism is, or the courage or the ability to survive in the most arduous situations known to man. Everybody wants to understand that. And so they want him to tell them, they want the secret of what he did. And his thing, you know, is, listen, I did what I was trained to do, and I'm telling a story to help the memory of these, my teammates, never die. And he did that, and he's done it. And now he's on to the next thing, which is to continue to influence people to develop their own never quit mindset.
I'm kind of a weirdo. So I can get along with anybody. I mean, I boil it down to this. So my whole life, I was little, and my family, we have to learn how to defend ourselves and fight and stuff like that. So, I mean, once you strip away all the white noise, and I learn something about somebody, and I just close my eyes so I can't, you know, if I'm not standing in front of them, and know everything about them, it's their experiences, right? And what they're capable of. And man, I find it that fascinating and get along with just about anybody. So when I was hanging out with all the celebrities or the politicians like that, I'm not asking for autographs or anything. I like hanging out with them because, man, they're good at something. Did I say that right?
Their stories. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So they have an experience in something that I'm not experienced in. And to go back to my friends, all the friends that I have since boyhood, they have a strength that covers down on a weakness I have. So when one of them dies, I'm exposed. And that's why it's so hard for us in the SEAL teams when one of us dies. And since we've had so many die, you know, we close ranks, I guess, best way to say it. So, I mean, and we deal with it together. You got to understand, I'm not alone. I talk to my teammates regularly. Even the guys that I didn't meet while I served, I run into them. And then the people in Hollywood still check in on me in the media, politics. I mean, it's kind of one of the deals I go out and hang out with a while and then just try to be friends. That's it.
So a lot of political stuff is happening kind of around you as well. It seems like people are asking you all sorts of random political questions, and it seems like a tough position to be in. Do you feel uniquely qualified to discuss things like, I don't know, gun control, for example, or do you think a lot of these people are kind of piggybacking on this?
Over the years, and since when I got out and became a public speaker and what I've been doing, if you see me on TV or if I'm at a political event, either Democrat or Republican, they bring me in for my perspective because, I'm 40 years old now. My last 40 years of my life, I lived every bit of it to the extreme and everything I could get myself into. And then when I became a public speaker, I mean, I travel around the country, the world, integrating into every town, city, from neighborhoods, you name it, and with the charity stuff. So I have a unique perspective on the country because I'm around it 300 days out of the year, most of the time, just getting to know all these people. And because most people know my background and what I'm got put into the public eye for, they open up to me. I don't want to say a lot easier than most people, but I mean, they trust me. They know what I'll do for them. I mean, and that's hardcore. In my family, what you need to know is, we have a saying, die for any woman, fight alongside any man. So that's kind of how I was raised. And once I meet somebody and it's just, they don't try and gotcha questions or pin me up or get me somewhere with it, where they shouldn't go with it.
It's authenticity.
Right. And I can defend, you know, I can defend myself now after being trained for a while. So it's not usually going to work out real well.
Well, a lot of my friends, especially conversations I've had with Art of Charm clients who are also in special operations, we tend to get a lot of special operations guys here. I think they realize just you guys have a different view of training, right? You look at training as a reward, some way to kind of get better, gain a 0.1% edge on something, and you take it. Whereas I think the civilian population looks at training often like, oh, I have to go to this dumb training because my boss thinks I'm stupid or my boss thinks I need help with this. And the ego gets in the way and looks at training in the civilian world like a need. Oh, you don't know this. You need improvement. And I feel like the special operations community looks at things differently from that. It's kind of a warrior thing, right? Looking at any kind of test of will or might or whatever drive as something that forges you out of steel versus something that's there to beat you down and put you in your place. Would you agree with that?
I'm going to go out like this. In civilian training, when you have a job, they send you to a school, learn how to do something. It's to get to the end game, right? And most people, when they're training for something, they see the end game and they train for it one direction. What we do in our community is there's all, the quickest way to get in between two points is a straight line, man. But And when that one goes bad, what are you going to do? So we actually trained for the 359 other different directions.
The omnidirectional 359 different degrees.
Every guy has a special skill set, and then every guy also has every other guy's skill set. So if you kill one of us, man, the other dude just steps up in his place and we roll. So you have to eliminate every one of us. I see that a lot of people find an excuse to get out of something, especially if it gets hard, right? We will find a scrap of something just to stay in it, just to stay there in it. And even if it's miserable. And the difference is because of our training and the world we live in, most people don't want to deal in the misery that we do.
Well, the application of pain is the essential ignition point for us,
and
right?
We thrive in it.
Right. And when you can translate somebody's psychology to not be resistant or fear of that pain, whether it's physical, mental, or emotional, you know, in those drivers, well, we conform to that pain, search for it, seek it out, because we know in the long run, when we are confronted with those extreme operational environments, when those high performance thresholds are required, we're not going to break. We're not going to crack. We've gone through the stress inoculation. We're ready. We're prepared. And like you said, in the civilian, I do a lot of corporate civilian training. I do a lot of private training and mentoring from professional athletes, the kids going in the SEAL training. And the reality is just natural civilians are preconditioned for that comfort zone behavioral pattern. And so when you apply pain in a training program, whatever the level it is, there's natural reluctance or resistance. For us, we gravitate. We're searching out the pain.
It's this too, man. Most people, when they start, they'll come in, they'll stretch, they'll start training. And then when they get tired or the pain, they'll quit. Well, our program is designed so when you wake up in the morning, it's the beatdown start. I mean, and then you're by the end of the day is when you do your training, right? So yeah, there's 11 beatdown evolutions. And then by the time you get to it, they're putting a gun in your hand. They're like, if you even make one mistake, you're out of here. They take us all the way down to nothing. And you're in the chaos, pain and all that stuff like threshold. And then you start training. And it's baby steps, right? I mean, it's literally baby, like how to hold
crawl,
your weapon.
Walk,
how to
run. Hold,
yeah, crawl, walk, run. That's why our process is so long. And that way, when the fight starts and then when we're tired, we know our enemy's tired. Well, when they're tired, they're done. When we're tired, we're just getting warmed up, right?
Right. So you train kind of laterally instead of vertically. You can all kind of replace each other's jobs and you seek out the pain, like you said. How can civilians develop some of that mental toughness and tenacity since we're never going through buds or war? How can civilians start to pick that up? Or is it literally not possible, which is why the training works and why it's so extreme in the first place?
I think one of the differences is the fact that it's how fast you can adapt to the pain and learn. Okay. And that has to do with a certain age. I mean, there's a mean average. They don't know why certain guys make it, but think about it like this. And I'll put it into perspective for you. So there's things you'll do as a child that you think are great. And then once you become a civilian, you're like, well, that's dangerous. And perfect example during buzz is one of the things they do is water, surf torture. So just throw us out in the water and leave us there, man. I mean, until guys will just quit, they'll break the cold water. They get you. If they don't like you, man, or if you don't get ready, they'll just put you in the cold water. Well, I kept calling home and telling Morgan, I was like, man, the surf torture water's cold. Well, he sent me a newspaper article of a 7-year-old boy who was down at the Hotel Del, had goggles on, swim trunks. And the caption said, you know, so-and-so had been frolicking in the water all day and loved it. And then literally down the way there, you got supposedly the hardest dudes on the planet laying in the water. Going, oh my God, I can't take this anymore. And it's a mind trip, right? And it's the guys who can see that, and that's all pain really is the mind saying, man, I don't, this isn't right. So let's get some pain in here and get us out of here. But once you can push past that part and you make it relative, because that pain and chaos is relative to the beholder, then that's how you advance. And that's how we succeed, man. There's like, there ain't nobody coming in here this way or this direction. Can this storm? Yeah, we will.
But Jordan, the thing is it possible for civilians? Absolutely. I mean, you look at, that's one of the founding points why Marcus and I started the Team Never Quit podcast, because we were intent on saying, showing people that you don't have to be a Navy SEAL in order to do the incredible, insane things that you can think of.
We all, you guys have the same skill sets we have. I mean, we just spent more time honing them in and collecting skill sets in different directions, right? So
two examples. We had Diana Nyad on, the woman who swam from Cuba to Florida, right? Spent 30 years trying to accomplish that task. You go, why the hell would anybody want to do that, right? Make the attempt five times. On the flip side, we had Jordan Romero, climbed Mount Everest at 13 years old, but this was after he had already climbed the highest peaks on five other continents, right? So what? They're not Navy SEALs. They have no desire to become Navy SEALs. So what is the trigger component from a motivational perspective in their minds that allows them to endure the pain and the conquest of that?
Different ages, different sexes. Is it an influence? Did they get hurt? Did they lose somebody? I mean, every human is built the same. We talk about science proving that, man. We can all accomplish the same thing. It's the drive in you and how bad you want it. How bad you dream about it.
Boom.
You think about it. Day and night. I mean, I was small and slow. And so I literally thought, all right, everybody is so good at this. If I kick this bag 500 times, that other dude must be doing 1,000. What else right. do I got going on? I mean, people rationalize their life in that ages. We don't do that. We rationalize day to day, man. And I hit 40 the other day and I'm just starting. I'm taking everything I learned when I was 40 and then starting something. People tend to slow down at the end of it and we just get fired up. And basically what we are is we have the ability to learn just about anything we have to succeed. That's what you learn going through SEAL training, because you can take it the worst of it. And then the most technical parts, I mean, we got guys in SEAL teams that just, they're so smart. I'm like, man, what are you doing in here?
Rocket scientist. And
it's just that guy. He's that kind of guy. I mean, we gravitate towards each other. And we have Harvard, Yale, I mean, Ivy Leaguers, just trust fund guys. And then you got
kids with their GEDs.
Yeah. Country boys like us and man.
Former gangbangers. I mean, it's remarkable.
Really?
And it goes back, Jordan, to what you're asking. Where is that trigger point that makes you want to endure the pain to submit to a training program that makes you the best? So how do civilians do it? First and foremost, establish a quest or challenge that's bigger than anything you can imagine, that when you lay it out in front of you, they're like, there's no way I'll ever be able to do that. Well, guess what? Sign up for it. Go for it.
Show
fail
up.
A million times.
Every guy says that, man, I never, you know, that other guy's going to be stronger than me. So he doesn't go. And then, everybody starts to say that and then no one shows up, man. That's no matter how many times I ever been hit, no matter times ever rut, man. The difference is just keep standing up, because eventually what happens, the guy next to you will not stand up. Right. And I joke about this the other day. We were talking about, like, guys will hear us in our, say a bunch of team guys are sitting around and we'll hear a story about a fight or a war story or something like that. And a lot of people be like, oh man, that is terrible. God, did everybody, man, I hope everybody's got it. And then there's guys like us who are like, oh, that was awful. I wish I was there. Oh my God, man. How awesome was that? Tell me about it. And then when you do that out loud, some people are like, what is it? And it's just, we've gone so far down our path that mentality is what makes us good at it. Right. You eat it up, man. I mean, and the deeper you get into it, the more you eat it up. And then when it's over, it's hard to transition out of it. But then if you think about it, by taking everything that I had learned and I can apply all that, not in this job. I wonder what I can accomplish in this job with all the skill sets I have, and just start randomly picking them out.
What mental practices do you guys use in the SEALs to block out things like distraction and physical pain so that you can stay focused on the goal at hand? Like, you talked about drawing that line in the sand after you lost the team and crawling until you cross the line and then you draw the new line. What mental practices, and what do you tap into now that the stakes aren't that high, right? Like, you're not crawling away from Taliban, but you still have to tap into something. What sort of mental practices are there that keep you moving forward when you hit resistance?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't look at it like, oh, I'm not glad I'm not crawling through. That's kind of, I know how far I can be pushed. And so do all the SEALs. Because if I could take that, every one of them can. That's the unique thing about me coming back, man, is like, they know how far we can take it now. Like the Hell Week and everything we did. All that training justified it, because I was out there and I had to go through it in real life. And I came back, and the guys who got, man, this, how hard they fought. So all the training and all the men that have that do that, man, they know they can take that. And that's kind of we got beat, man, but there's victory and defeat. They say every gunfight is the same. It's just who you're with makes it different, right? And that's there's a lot of truth in that. So
for sure. And I think, you know, Jordan, what you're asking is you want to say, all right, well, now that you know, we started a podcast. How, you know, we're, it's certainly, there's no, you know, the existential reality of our death is not going to occur if we blow an interview. That's for sure. But what we think about is, all right, we want to become the best possible podcast we can do, or he wants to become the best possible father. We frame the reference. Granted, you know, the immediacy of our death isn't staring us at it in the face every single second, but establishing those goals, right? The criteria that we know that we need to be objective about in order to accomplish those goals, to chip away and to go through that painful process of growth to become experts or elite at whatever we're choosing to do.
In the military, it's called squared away. And people, when we get out, they call it OCD and all stuff like that. So when I get up in the morning, check my wife's tires, and if we're going on a trip, we're always prepared.
Do you guys know Jocko Willink by any chance? You know Jocko?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You guys do. Yeah. So we're talking about being prepared as well. And it's as soon as I went down to San Diego to talk with him, the batteries ran out. One of the microphones broke and all this stuff. And I had backups of each of those things. And he was kind of chuckling because he's like, yeah, that's one thing that we definitely share is that kind of OCD. Like, well, good thing I have an extra everything in my suitcase, which is unusual. Usually when people run out of things, and just looking at my own past experience, you're screwed. But, you know, what can I say? The Boy Scouts and the Navy SEALs have that in common, right? Be prepared to the point where you're kind of overthinking it maybe, but the second you don't overthink it, you find that's when you need it.
It can get bad.
One is none, right? One is none. And how did you learn that, Jordan, right? You learned it either through influence, through somebody teaching you in a training component, or you learned the hard way because you messed up.
And yeah,
the hard way.
Well, I mean, yeah. Then I, like for me, for instance, I was kind of one of those team guys. Well, if two is one, then I need seven watches. You walk into my locker, you're like nine knives. Until somebody was getting out of retiring, I'm like, what do you got in that golden cruise box? Especially when you're a new guy. I mean, it's because you're so excited that it's all new. And then you learn as what you're saying, and Jocko, that two is one is none. That is an absolute critical must write down on every leadership deal, man, because it will go wrong.
I think for sure the lessons that you learn the hard way are the ones you remember the most, right? The ones that you learn through influence are all fine and good. But I'll tell you, the reason I overpack underwear for every trip that I do nowadays is because one day at Boy Scout camp, I shat myself in the middle of the night and there was no backup. And you go, note to self, 8-year-old Jordan, bring underwear, more pairs than you need, you know, and you just do it. And it's always about the hard lesson.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you haven't shat yourself, you just haven't learned that underwear lesson, right?
Right.
You won't. You'll just think it's all academic. It'll be academic to you. Thanks for listening and supporting The Art of Charm. For a list of all of the amazing sponsors and discount codes, visit theartofcharm.com/advertisers. Now back to the show. I got to ask, there's something called imposter syndrome that a lot of folks write in. They say they have this. Have you guys heard of imposter syndrome? Are you familiar with this?
I've never heard of it.
Imposter syndrome is when you feel like you're the only person that maybe got into that university slipping through the cracks and you don't really belong there. Or you got promoted to XYZ level, but really it's only a matter of time till other people find out you're a fraud and you don't belong there. And I had it when I worked on Wall Street as an attorney. Oh, I'm the dumbest one here. You know, they're going to find out I'm not a good lawyer. I'm wondering, do SEALs suffer from imposter syndrome like other high performers?
I cannot believe they labeled that.
Well, they've studied it extensively. You know, the cats in Cambridge.
How the hell can you label that?
Well,
when you go in and the people around you are high performers, you're like, man, I got to put out every day just to hell. I know, man. Wait a minute. Now I have a label on me now. What are you talking about, man? No, it keeps you driving forward, man. It's that not perfection, because I always say, you know, don't master anything. Understand as much as you can. And imposter syndrome.
Well, it's the interesting thing in our community is, right, we kind of flip it around. So it's not
people who they think that's a problem, man. Maybe I shouldn't talk on this, man. You're fine. You're good to go. Never quit, man. Just keep getting in there.
Well, so God, for us, it's you're all the peer evaluation and the peer review context of our community is so overwhelming that It's built in. So we intentionally drive
earn your tribe every day.
We drive that fear into each new guy, into each student. Intentionally, we want them to feel I don't belong. I can't be here. And it's those kids that quit that were like, sweet, get out of here, because those are the people who cave into the imposter syndrome. But we want the people that will elevate and get to a point where they then turn it around and start imposing it themselves.
Imposter syndrome, does that include quitting? I mean, up to quitting, right?
It doesn't mean they quit. It doesn't mean they quit. It just means they feel like, oh, fuck, I'm the guy here who's got to outwork everyone
I'm not a big deal. Every SEAL thinks that, man. It's that they quit. That's the difference, right? Right. Between we just don't quit. I mean, like, yeah, I know I'm not any good, but I was good enough today. And we literally say earn our Trident every day. You could come into work for 10 years and do everything perfect. And then you screw up. And then mustering be like, man, gee, what a trail dude came in late. And I was fine. I mean, and then the next 6 months you're having to build your reputation. It's called building your reputation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the reason that high performers have this is in part because we do judge ourselves so harshly, but it seems like SEALs wouldn't be immune to that. It seems like every time you do a boat race or whatever, you're looking at, man, we came in second. You know, oh, it's probably my fault. Yeah. I got to work harder next time. I hope the chief didn't notice that maybe I was lollygagging or tired. I mean, it seems like every high performer has this. And a lot of the show fans wanted to know if you guys felt that way or if you guys always felt good and confident about what you were doing and your position in the teams.
Well, they exploit that.
They exploit it, like you're saying. And the greatest thing, at least I know for me and for when I had students, you know, the whole thing is to really instill a sense that if I'm not feeling that, then I'm letting my teammate down and they're not going to have the trust in me that when it really goes for real, that I'm going to screw up and I'm not going to be there for them. So we drive that into them.
Actions speak. That's what actions are. I mean, they constantly tell you you're not good enough. You're not supposed to be here every single day. And then we do an evolution, then you fail it. But at the end of the day, if you're standing there and they're like, see you tomorrow, then I mean,
sweet.
I thought, not only did I not think I was good enough, he told me I was not good enough every single day, but now I'm here and I'll be here in the morning. And then I was there the next day and then I graduated. So they don't ever tell you congratulations. I mean, I don't even remember. Is it graduation when you pass over that threshold and they're like, you're a loser. You're not going to, you don't belong here. Cause it doesn't remember when you get in the team.
In the unlikely event that you do graduate all the way up to the day of graduation.
And then when you graduate, you get to the team, you're a new guy. And then after one platoon, you're a one platoon wonder. And then you're a two pump chump. And then, I mean, literally you have to be the CNO.
The highest. Then they keep that performance. The tier one units apply that pressure and that peer evaluation on each other. It's part of keeping the edge sharp. And it's, I believe personally, it's the greatest contribution that we have to maintain the brotherhood,
devotion,
and the willingness to sacrifice at the highest possible level for each other, up to including our own deaths.
If we knew we had to get waterboarded every day in one of the phases, guys would still, we'd do it. We did get water. I mean, like, all right, that's this part of the program. This sucks, man. These guys get waterboarded, but you know, you might even die. I mean, guys die and it doesn't matter. I mean, it's the weirdest thing. I never talked about it out loud. God, we're nuts, dude. Can you believe that? tie your hands and feet together and throw us in the deep end. Great. That dude can't even swim anyways.
This all speaks to a nearly maniacal level of competitive instinct, either with other people or most likely with yourself. Would you say that's the case with you? I mean, I know you started training to be a SEAL when you were 14. Most 14-year-old kids are watching cartoons. So seems like something that was either born in you or developed very early on. And do you see that with Rutt, especially you having seen a bunch of guys in training? Do you think that this is something that you're born or develop early on, or is this something where you could take a schlup and turn them into somebody who could last and do this?
Well, I'll go first. And I think Marcus and I have a kind of a little different views on it. I believe because, you know, they've been trying to study this for the past 30 years at our program. They've really dug in and tried to understand who's the kid that's going to make it. And I'll tell you, when I was in Buds and I'm sitting there and I'm getting hammered at the combat training tank or out on the beach, the guy on my right is a former gangbanger from Denver who has a GED. The guy on my left has an English lit degree from Clemson. The guy behind me worked on Wall Street. The guy in front of me was from Arkansas, who barely graduated high school, never played sports. It was a loner, and we're all in there doing the same thing. And so what that says to me, it's, I don't know if necessarily say if it's, I think the instructors to a certain extent can be maniacal. It's not the intention. I get it all the time. Why are you guys sadists? Is the pain pleasurable? All this crazy. No, it's part of the psychological development, right? We need to push the individual to the submission point to where they can begin to realize that the success is not a personalized success. It's not, oh yeah, I'm squared away. I'm competitive. I can hang. I'm the best. It's no, I can endure this to make sure the guy next to me has confidence in me to go to combat with me.
That's why we train our own. I mean, the guys coming after you are a byproduct of our generation as instructors and what we went through. So, I mean, if we went through hell and then they're instructors now, those guys coming through are going to go through it. It's all about proving yourself to the guys who went before you. And I don't know if that sounds right or anything, to take it to an athlete's point and maniacal or whatever. Well, I mean, that's kind of one of those deals too, where athletes train to win no matter what sport they're in. Our sport is combat. We train to win. Winning means we're going to kill.
And that translates to the financial industry.
Anything, right?
I mean, I do a truckload of work in the top private wealth guys in New York City and Chicago and Boston and work with those firms and these guys. And you know what? They love to talk about their lifestyle as this combative, gladiatorial environment. And so, they want to push themselves to.
And it is in that arena.
True. And so it translates across the board. We just have a unique perspective because of the magnitude, intensity of actual pain that's involved and how rapidly we can wipe a person's cultural coding and then reprogram them with what we need them to do from a selfless perspective on the battlefield.
So do you think that someone without military training can cultivate and maintain the self-discipline to do the difficult things necessary, to really crush their goals? Or is this something unique to SEALs? Because I feel like what you're teaching, I mean, tell us what you're doing and teaching it at Team Never Quit. I mean, how are you bringing these mindsets by through training?
Here's the mistake everybody makes. All right. And this is what they teach us from the very beginning. All right. Everyone always sees the end game, the guy hitting the home run in the World Series, the Navy SEAL doing, the Vint Lottery. And what we do at T&Q is we show you that with all the end games, the beginnings are the same. All right. And I mean, it starts with just getting up and walk into something or studying something. Eventually you study long enough, you get good at it. Well, and youth is a tool. I mean, we back this up. I mean, I don't suggest you go through SEAL training at 70 or anything. I mean, have at it. Hey, that guy who ran through Australia, how old was he, man?
He's like 68 or something.
So what we teach you and what we try to we bring all these exceptional people on who've done these just incredible things in every field. And we boil it all the way down to the beginning. And everyone always says relatively the same thing, maybe in a different format, but it's always like, hey, I just got up, man. I set a goal for myself. I never let anybody tell me that I couldn't do it. Even if they did, I didn't believe it. And I just kept going. I mean, what else are you going to do? You're not going to stop. And that's what we do in the very beginning. I mean, it is as simple as standing in a line from tallest to shortest. And then it's just how fast we have to learn it and the environment we do it. And you have to want it. I mean, and depending on what you're trying to accomplish is going to depending on how bad you want it, man. Because in our world, you have to take not only the mental pain, you got to take the physical pain and then the emotional pain when our guys die. I mean, there's a whole truckload of stuff that comes with it. But you can pick something in your life that doesn't have to take you that far down the rabbit's hole. And and getting up to that point is simply like, man, you learned how to work this microphone. So did I learned how to work the computer. So did somebody else. Just keep working at all. Everyone always transitions from one to the other and leaves the other one behind, thinking that it's going to be, it's in there, it's good to go. We don't do that. We just, we always circle back to the beginning and retrain and retrain and retrain. They say that someone who has mastered something has just mastered the basics. And once you get that, it's called your baseline. And that means no one can push you past that. I mean, the politicians, everybody with like with the SEALs, they draw the lines in the sand. And when all those wash away, we're the baseline.
The Team Never Quit podcast, what our goal is to say, hey, there's a commonality throughout the human condition, no matter where you're from, what culture, what socioeconomic background, you know, there's a playing field, a baseline that's out there. And the baseline is your decision to say, yeah, I'm going to get stand back up, or I'm going to make that line, I'm going to crawl to it. I'm going to make that line and I'm going to crawl to it enough times to where you hit that place where nothing's going to stop you from achieving your objective.
And then you get there and then you're there. All of a sudden you're like, man, I didn't even realize all we did all this. And I know it's in my head now, but because you're at the end game and that's the success, whatever, being the professional athlete, the Navy SEAL or something like that. And then when you look back on it, it was all worth it.
I'll give you a perfect example, Jordan. We had Dustin Pedroia on from the Red Sox, right? Arguably probably one of the top second basemen in Red Sox history. And his whole never quit thing was everybody always told him he was never going to make it to the next level because he was the smallest kid on the field, because he wasn't big and fast and all this, but he worked harder than everybody else. And so every place he got, he wouldn't take no for answer. He wouldn't quit. He kept going back. To the entire flip side, we had Laura Logan on recently, and her never quit story was the fact she didn't quit while she was getting gang raped by 200 crazy people in Trafalgar Square in Egypt. And it was came down to the simple, most simplistic form of never quitting is just take a breath. And all she could say to herself was just take a breath, take a breath. So that's what we're trying to expose people, whether it's through the Team Never Quit speakers that are out there, whether it's through the podcast, is that, listen, there's a place in all of us where if you can keep that fire in your gut burning, no matter how fast or how much external the combat of life is pummeling the snot out of you, if you just keep that fire lit and figure out what your fuel is, nothing's going to stop you, no matter what.
I mean, you can't be broken mentally because they can't touch your mind, right? I mean, they can't get in there and other than a stroke or something. So think about it like that. And the body wants to stay alive. That's another thing that happens in the SEAL teams, man. We know what the physical and even you guys, man, and y'all know this, Jordan, man, your body can take so much. It wants to stay alive. There's mechanisms in it that'll heal it by itself. And I mean, just as long as that mind is pushing it.
Well, guys, thank you. Thank you so much for indulging our questions here. Is there anything left that you haven't said that you want to make sure you deliver to the AOC family? Anything I haven't asked you?
I think one of the biggest things that people need to understand about Marcus and Marcus's backstory, and I'm going to speak for you here, brother, because I love you, is you got to understand that here's a guy. Yes. In looking at his story, it's remarkable, right? He's never going to say that. But from an outsider's perspective, when you look at the fact that he never quit on that mountain that day, he survived. But then he went, joined another SEAL platoon, went back to combat in Ramadi, and then got out and then carried the name of his brothers for as long as he did, the success of the book, you know, the movie itself, and now continues to influence, whether it's in the political arena, whether it's in, you know, with celebrities, or more importantly, for the average person who tunes into our podcast, is to give inspiration and hope that you don't have to be a Navy SEAL to never quit. You have it inside you. And so, you know, to understand that you can, you know, again, going back to what he says, is you're not defined. He's not defined as a Navy SEAL anymore. I mean, it's a component of his life that he's able to utilize now as a person of influence for the never quit mindset. And that's the mission. And that's why, you know, that's why we do what we do. And that's why we get on board on the Team Never Quit that Marcus started.
Well, thanks so much, guys. Really appreciate the candor and your energy and your advice today. I think a lot of people are going to get value from hearing about, well, first of all, that everybody has the imposter syndrome, and also that it's possible to move yourself past anything that you've previously thought possible. And you guys are living proof of that. And Rudd, I really appreciate you coming on as well as Marcus, because Frankly, we didn't know exactly that you were going to come on, and we weren't really sure. I think it wasn't confirmed. So you did a great job of kind of improvising, surprise, surprise, even though we were less prepared to have you on.
Thank you, Jordan, for what you said, man. And it's my pleasure. Thanks for adapting and allowing me to come on with Marcus.
I've been thinking about this imposter syndrome thing. I can't believe I haven't. They went, so it's kind of one of, if you've talked to people who say they have that and they're in that position, it's probably somebody telling them that they're not good enough. And if, even if they are thinking that, you need to tell them that, man, maybe they've taken what they're doing as far as they can, and that's them needing to shift, because your body talks to you. I mean, that the spidey sense, the hair standing on top of your neck, man, if you're just uncomfortable or unhappy, I mean, move on. Take all the knowledge you gained in that one deal and push to the next one. Look, man, don't beat yourself down. Don't think tell yourself that you're not good enough, man, because people are going to be doing that around you. Let them think that, and then just keep that fired. I mean, that's all, you know, we ever had.
Thanks so much, guys. Take care. It was good talking to those guys. It took forever to book them because Marcus speaks a lot everywhere, and he's probably done a lot of talking about the same story, so it's kind of cool to get something different out of those two guys. If you enjoyed this one, don't forget to thank Marcus and Rutt on Twitter. We'll have that linked in the show notes as well as the other resources mentioned on the show. You can, by the way, tap the album art, so you can tap the image of us, the cartoon image of us on your screen, on your phone screen, and the show notes will show up on your phone. I'm also on Twitter. A lot of people engage with me there. I post a lot of stuff that doesn't make it to the show. That's at The Art of Charm on Twitter. Boot camps and live program details to learn directly from us here at AOC, bootcamp.theartofcharm.com. And remember, we sell out a few months in advance. So if you're thinking about it a little bit, get in touch with us ASAP. Get some info from us so you can plan ahead. And I also want to encourage you to join the AOC Challenge. That's theartofcharm.com/challenge. Or if you're here in the States, you can text CHARMED to 33444. That's CHARMED to 33444. We've designed the challenge to improve your networking ability, your connection ability, and to inspire those around you to develop personal and professional relationships with you. And we'll also send you that fundamentals toolbox that I mentioned earlier in the show with all the body language and persuasion stuff. And I also do regular videos with drills and exercises to help you move forward. And I do one of those every single week along with Q&A here and there. So it's a lot of fun for me anyway. And you guys seem to like it as well. It will make you a better networker, a better connector, and a better thinker, which is really important. At the end of the day, that's the most important. That's theartofcharm.com/challenge or text CHARMED in the U.S. to 33444. For full show notes for this and all previous episodes, head on over to theartofcharm.com/podcast. This episode of The Art of Charm was produced by Jason DeFilippo. Jason Sanderson is our audio engineer and editor. Show notes on the website are by Robert Fogarty. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Go ahead, tell your friends, because the greatest compliment you can give us is a referral to someone else, either in person or shared on the web. So stay charming and leave everything and everyone better than you found them.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Charm. Get more confidence, relationship skills, life hacks, and more at theartofcharmpodcast.com.